"I'll get the bastard this time," the gunner promised, adjusting his sights down a hair. The poor bastard out there didn't even know he'd been shot at the first time. "Fire! Firing!" Yet another recoil and, "Hit! Good shooting, Vanya!" 3 Company was doing well. The time spent in gunnery practice was paying off handsomely, Komonov thought. This was much better than sitting in a damned bunker and waiting for them to come to you. "What is that?" Marshal Luo asked. "Comrade Marshal, come here and see," the young lieutenant colonel urged. "What is this?" the defense minister asked with a trailing-off voice. "Kaunima," he breathed. Then he thundered. "What the hell is this?" "Comrade Marshal, this is a website from the Internet. It purports to be a live television program from the battlefield in Siberia." The young field-grade officer was almost breathless. "It shows the Russians fighting 34th Shock Army." "And?" "And they're slaughtering our men, according to this," the lieutenant colonel went on. "Wait a minute. What? How is this possible?" Luo demanded. "Comrade, this heading here says Dark Star. Dark Star is the name of an American unmanned aerial vehicle, a reconnaissance drone, reported to be a stealth aircraft used to collect tactical intelligence. Thus, it appears that they are using this to feed information and putting the information on the Internet as a propaganda tool." He had to say it that way, and it was, in fact, the way he thought about it. "Tell me more." The officer was an intelligence specialist. "This explains the success they've had against us, Comrade Marshal. They can see everything we do, almost before we do it. It's as though they listen to our command circuit, or even listen into our staff and planning meetings. There is no defense against this," the staff officer concluded. "You young defeatist!" the marshal raged. "Perhaps there is a way to overcome this advantage, but I do not know what it is. Systems like this can see in the dark as well as they can in the sunlight. Do you understand, Comrade Marshal? With this tool, they can see everything we do, see it long before we approach their formations. It eliminates any possibility of surprise. See here," he said, pointing at the screen. "One of 34th Army's mechanized divisions is maneuvering east. They are here," he pointed to a printer map on the table. "And the enemy is here. If our troops get to this point unseen, then perhaps they can hit the Russians on their left flank. But it will take 2 hours to get there. For the Russians to get one of their units to a blocking position will take but 1 hour. That is the advantage," he concluded. "The Americans do that to us?" "Clearly the feed on the Internet is from America, from their CIA." "This is how the Russians have countered us, then?" "Clearly. They've outguessed us at every turn today. This must be how they do it." "Why do the Americans put this information out where everyone can see it?" Luo wondered. The obvious answer didn't occur to him. Information given out to the public had to be carefully measured and flavored for the peasants and workers to draw the proper conclusions from it. "Comrade, it will be difficult to say on state television that things are going well when this is available to anyone with a computer." "Ah!" Less a sound of satisfaction than one of sudden dread. "Anyone can see this?" "Anyone with a computer and a telephone line?" The young lieutenant colonel looked up, only to see Luo's receding form. "I'm surprised he didn't shoot me," the officer observed. "He still might," a full colonel told him. "But I think you frightened him." He looked at the wall clock. It was 16 hours, 4 in the afternoon. "Well, it is a concern." "You young fool, don't you see? Now he can't even conceal the truth from the Politburo." "Hello, Yuri," Clark said. It was different to be in Moscow in time of war. The mood of the people on the street was unlike anything he'd ever seen. They were concerned and serious. You didn't go to Russia to see the smiling people any more than you went to England for the coffee. But there was something else, too. Indignation. Anger. Determination. Television coverage of the war was not as strident and defiant as he'd expected. The new Russian news media were trying to be even-handed and professional. There was commentary to the effect that the army's inability to stop the Chinese cold spoke ill of their country's national cohesion. Others lamented the demise of the Soviet Union, whom China would not have dared to threaten, much less attack. Moore asked what the hell was the use of being in NATO if none of the other countries came to the aid of their supposed new ally. "We told the television people that if they told anyone of the American division now in Siberia, we'd shoot them. And, of course, they believed us," Lieutenant General Karelin said with a smile. That was something new for Clark and Chavez to see. He hadn't smiled much in the past week. "Things looking up?" Chavez inquired.
"Bondarenko has stopped them at the gold mine. They will not even see that, if my information is correct. But there is something else," he added seriously.
"What's that, Yuri?" Clark asked.
"We are concerned that they might launch their nuclear weapons."
"Oh, shit," Ding observed. "How serious is that?"
"It comes from your president. Golovko is speaking with President Grushevoy right now."
"And?"
"How do they plan to go about it? Smart bombs?" John asked.
"No. Washington has asked us to go in with a special operations team," Karelin said. "What the hell?" John gasped. He pulled his satellite phone out of his pocket and looked for the door. "Excuse me, General. E.T. phone home."
"You want to say that again, Ed?" Foley heard.
"You heard me. They've run out of the bombs they need. Evidently, it's a pain in the ass to fly bombs to where the bombers are."
"Fuck,"
the CIA officer observed, out in the parking lot of this Russian Army Officers Club. The encryption on his phone didn't affect the emotion in his voice. "Don't tell me, since Rainbow is a NATO asset, and Russia's part of NATO now, and since you're going to be asking the fucking Russians to front this operation, in the interest of North Atlantic solidarity, we're going to get to go and play too, right?"
"Unless you choose not to, John. I know you can't go yourself. Combat's a kid's game, but you have some good kids working for you."
"Ed, you expect me to send my people in on something like that, and I stay home and fucking knit socks?" Clark demanded heatedly.
"That's your call to make. You're the Rainbow Commander."
"How is this supposed to work? You expect us to jump in?"
"Helicopters.
Russian helicopters. No thanks, buddy.
Our choppers, John. First Armored Division had enough, and they're the right kind."
"They want me to do what?"
Dick Boyle asked.
"You heard me.
What about fuel?"
"Your fueling point's right about here," Colonel Masterman said, holding the just-downloaded satellite photo. "Hilltop west of a place called Chichang. Nobody lives there, and the numbers work out."
"Yeah, except our flight path takes us within 10 miles of this fighter base. 8 F-111s are going to hit it while you're on the way in. Ought to close down their runways for a good 3 days, they figure."
"Dick," Diggs said, "I don't know what the problem is exactly, but Washington is really worried that Joe is going to launch his ICBMs at us at home, and Gus Wallace doesn't have the right bombs to take them out reliably. That means a special ops force, down and dirty. It's a strategic mission, Dick. Can you do it?"
Colonel Boyle looked at the map, measuring distance in his mind.
"Yeah, we'll have to mount the outrigger wings on the Blackhawks and load up to the max on gas, but, yeah, we got the range to get there. Have to refuel on the way back, though."
"Okay, can you use your other birds to ferry the fuel out?"
Boyle nodded.
"Barely. If necessary, the Russians can land a Spetsnaz force anywhere through here with additional fuel, so they tell me. This part of China is essentially unoccupied, according to the maps."
"What about opposition on the ground?"
"There is a security force in the area. We figure maybe 100 people on duty, total, say a squad at each silo. Can you get some Apaches out there to run interference?"
"Yeah, they can get that far, if they travel light. Just cannon rounds and 2.75-inch rockets," he thought.
"Then get me your mission requirements," General Diggs said.
It wasn't quite an order. If he said it was impossible, then Diggs couldn't make him do it. But Boyle couldn't let his people go out and do something like this without being there to command them.
The MI-24s finished things off.
The Russian doctrine for their attack helicopters wasn't too different from how they used their tanks. Indeed, the Mi-24, called the Hind by NATO, but strangely unnamed by the Russians themselves, was referred to as a flying tank. Using 86 spiral missiles, they finished off a Chinese tank battalion in 20 minutes of jump and shoot, sustaining only 2 losses in the process. The sun was setting now, and what had been 34th Shock Army was wreckage. What few vehicles had survived the day were pulling back, usually with wounded men clinging to their decks. In his command post, General Sinyavsky was all smiles. Vodka was snorted by all. His 265th Motor Rifle Division had halted and thrown back a force more than double its size, suffering fewer than 300 dead in the process. The TV news crews were finally allowed out to where the soldiers were, and he delivered the briefing, paying frequent compliments to his theater commander, Gennady Yosefovich Bondarenko, for his cool head and faith in his subordinates. "He never lost his nerve," Sinyavsky said soberly. "And he allowed us to keep ours for when the time came. He is a hero of Russia," the division commander concluded. "And so are many of my men." "Thank you for that, Yuri Andreevich, and yes, for that you will get your next star," the theater commander told the television screen. Then he turned to his staff. "Andrei Petrovich, what do we do tomorrow?"
"I think we will let 265 start moving south. We will be the hammer, and Diggs will be the anvil. They still have a Type A group army largely intact to the south, the 43rd. We will smash it starting day after tomorrow, but first we will maneuver it into a place of our choosing."
Bondarenko nodded.
"Show me a plan, but first I am going to sleep for a few hours."
"Yes, Comrade General." Chapter 60 Skyrockets in Flight. It was the same Spetsnaz people they'd trained for the past month or so. Nearly everyone on the transport aircraft was a commissioned officer, doing sergeant's work, which had its good points and its bad ones. The really good thing was that they all spoke passable English. Of the Rainbow Troopers, only Ding Chavez and John Clark spoke conversational Russian. The maps and photos came from SVR and CIA, the latter transmitted to the American Embassy in Moscow and messengered to the military airfield out of which they'd flown. They were in an Aeroflot airliner, fairly full with over 100 passengers, all of them soldiers.
"I propose that we divide by nationalities," Kirillin said. "Vanya, you and your rainbow men take this one here. My men and I will divide the rest among us, using our existing squad structures."
"Looks okay, Yuri. One target's pretty much as good as another. When will we be going in?"
"Just before dawn. Your helicopters must have good range to take us all the way down, then back with only one refueling."
"Well, that'll be the safe part of the mission."
"Except this fighter base at Anshan," Kirillin said. "We pass within 20 kilometers of it."
"Air Force is going to hit that, they tell me. Stealth fighters with smart bombs. They're going to post-hole the runways before we drive past."
"Ah, that is a fine idea," Kirillin said.
"Kind of like that myself," Chavez said.
"Well, Mr. C, looks like I get to be a soldier again. It's been a while."
"What fun," Clark observed.
"Oh, yeah, sitting in the back of a helicopter, going deep into Indian country, where there were sure to be people with guns. Well, could be worse. Going in at dawn, at least the gomers on duty would be partly asleep, unless their boss was a real prick."
How tough was discipline in the People's Liberation Army, John wondered.
Probably pretty tough. Communist governments didn't encourage backtalk.
"How exactly are we supposed to disable the missiles?" Ding asked.
"They're fueled by a 10-centimeter pipe, 2 of them, actually, from underground fueling tanks adjacent to the launch silo. First, we destroy the pipes," Kirillin said. "Then we look for some way to access the missile silo itself. A simple hand grenade will suffice. These are delicate objects. They will not sustain much damage," the general said confidently.
What if the warhead goes off? Ding asked. Karelin actually laughed at that.
They will not, Domingo Stepanovich. These items are very secure in their arming procedures, for all the obvious reasons. And the sites themselves will not be designed to protect against a direct assault. They are designed to protect against nuclear blast, not a squad of engineer soldiers. You can be sure of that.
Hope you're right on that one, fella, Chavez didn't say aloud.
You seem knowledgeable on this subject, Yuri.
Vanya, this mission is one Spetsnaz has practiced more than once. We Russians have thought from time to time about taking these missiles. How you say, take them out of play, yes?
Not a bad idea at all, Yuri.
Not my kind of weapons, Clark said.
He really did prefer to do his killing close enough to see the bastard's face. Old habits died hard, and a telescopic sight was just as good as a knife in that respect.
Much better.
A rifle bullet didn't make people flop around and make noise the way a knife across the throat did. But death was supposed to be administered one at a time, not whole cities at once. It just wasn't tidy or selective enough. Chavez looked at his Team 2 troopers. They didn't look overtly tense, but good soldiers did their best to hide such feelings. Of their number, only Ettore Falcone wasn't a career soldier, but instead a cop from the Italian Carabinieri, which was about halfway between military and police. Chavez went over to see him.
"How you doing, Big Bird?" Ding asked.
"It is tense, this mission, though," Falcone replied.
"It might be. You never really know until you get there."
The Italian shrugged.
"As with raids on mafiosi, sometimes you kick the door and there is nothing but men drinking wine and playing cards. Sometimes they have macchina pistoli, but you must kick the door to find out."
"You do a lot of those?"
"8," Falcone replied. "I am usually the first one through the door because I am usually the best shot. But we have good men on the team there. And we have good men on the team here. It should go well, Domingo."
"I am tense, yes, but I will be all right."
"You will see," Big Bird ended. Chavez clapped him on the shoulder and went off to see Sergeant Major Price.
"Hey, Eddie.
Do we have a better idea for the mission yet?"
"Getting there. Looks like mainly a job for Patty, blowing things up."
"Connolly's the best explosives man I've ever seen," Price observed. "But don't tell him that. His head's swollen enough already."
"What about Falcone?"
"Ettore?"
Price shook his head.
"I will be very surprised if he puts a foot wrong. He's a very good man, Ding. Bloody machine. A robot with a pistol. That sort of confidence rarely goes bad. Things are too automatic for him."
"Okay, well, we've picked our target. It's the north and eastmost silo. Looks like it's on fairly flat ground. 2 4-inch pipes running to it. Patty'll blow those and then try to find a way to pop the cover off the silo or otherwise find an access door. There's one on the overhead. Then get inside, toss a grenade to break the missile, and we get the hell out of Dodge City."
"Usual division of the squad?" Price asked.
It had to be, but there was no harm in making sure.
Chavez nodded.
"You take Patty, Louis, Hank, and Dieter, and your team handles the actual destruction of the missile. I take the rest to do security and overwatch."
Price nodded as Patty Connolly came over.
"Are we getting chemical gear?"
"What?" Chavez asked.
"Ding, if we're going to be playing with bloody liquid-fueled missiles, we need chemical warfare gear. The fuels for these things, you don't want to breathe the vapor, trust me. Red fuming nitric acid, nitrogen tetroxide, hydrazine, that sort of thing. Those are bloody corrosive chemicals they use to power rockets. Not like a pint of bitter at the Green Dragon, I promise you. And if the missiles are fueled and we blow them, well, you don't want to be close, and you definitely don't want to be downwind. The gas cloud will be bloody lethal, like what you chaps use in America to execute murderers, but rather less pleasant."
"I'll talk to John about that." Chavez made his way back forward.
"Oh, shit," Ed Foley observed when he took the call. "Okay, John, I'll get hold of the army on that one. How long till you're there?"
"Hour and a half to the airfield."
"You okay?"
Yeah, sure, Ed. Never been better. Foley was struck by the tone. Clark had been CIA's official iceman for close to 20 years. He'd gone out on all manner of field operations without so much as a blink. But being over 50, had it changed him? Or did he just have a better appreciation of his own mortality now? The DCI figured that sort of thing came to everybody. Okay, I'll get back to you. He switched phones. I need General Moore. Yes, Director, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said in greeting. What can I do for you? Our special operations people say they need chemical warfare gear for their mission, and way ahead of you, Ed. SOCOM told us the same thing. First Armored's got the right stuff, and it'll be waiting for them at the field. Thanks, Mickey. How secure are those silos? The fueling pipes are right in the open. Blowing them up ought not to be a problem. Also, every silo has a metal access door for the maintenance people, and again, getting into it ought not to be a problem. My only concern is the site security force. There may be as much as a whole infantry battalion spread out down there. We're waiting for a KH-11 to overfly the site now for a final check. Well, Diggs is sending Apaches down to escort the raiding force. That'll be an equalizer, Moore promised. What about the command bunker? It's centrally located, looks pretty secure, entirely underground, but we have a rough idea of the configuration from penetrating radar. Foley referred to the KH-14 La Crosse satellite. NASA had once published radar photos that had shown underground tributaries of the Nile that emptied into the Mediterranean Sea at Alexandria. But the capability hadn't been developed for hydrologists. It had also spotted Soviet missile silos that the Russians had thought to be well camouflaged, and other sensitive facilities. And America had wanted to let the Russians know that the locations were not the least bit secret. Mickey, how do you feel about the mission? I wish we had enough bombs to do it, General Moore replied honestly. Yeah, the DCI agreed. The Politburo meeting had gone past midnight. So, Marshal Luo, Chan said, things went badly yesterday. How badly? We need the truth here, he concluded roughly. If nothing else, Chan Kun had made his name in the past few days, as the only Politburo member with the courage to take on the ruling clique, expressing openly the misgivings that they'd all felt. Depending on who won, it could mean his downfall, either all the way to death or simply to mere obscurity. But it seemed he didn't care. That made him unusual among the men in the room, Fang Gan thought, and it made him a man to be respected. There was a major battle yesterday between 34th Shock Army and the Russians. It appears to have been a draw, and we are now maneuvering to press our advantage, the defense minister told them. They were all suffering from fatigue in the room, and again the finance minister was the only one to rise to his words. In other words, a battle was fought and we lost it, Qian shot back. I didn't say that, Luo responded angrily. But it is the truth, is it not? Qian pressed the point. I told you the truth, Qian, was the thundering reply. Comrade Marshal, the finance minister said in a reasonable tone. You must forgive me for my skepticism. You see, much of what you've said in this room has turned out to be less than completely accurate. Now, I do not blame you for this. Perhaps you have been misinformed by some of your subordinates. All of us are vulnerable to that, are we not? But now is the time for a careful examination of objective realities. I am developing the impression that objective reality may be adverse to the economic and political objectives on whose pursuit this body has sent our country and its people. Therefore, we must now know what the facts are, and what also are the dangers facing us. So, Comrade Marshal, now, what is the military situation in Siberia? It has changed somewhat, Luo admitted. Not entirely to our benefit, but the situation is by no means lost. He'd chosen his words a little too carefully. By no means lost, everyone around the table knew, was a delicate way of saying that a disaster had taken place.
As in any society, if you knew the aphorisms, you could break the code. Success here was always proclaimed in the most positive terms. Setbacks were brushed aside without admission as something less than a stunning success. Failure was something to be blamed on individuals who'd failed in their duty, often to their great misfortune. But a real policy disaster was invariably explained as a situation that could yet be restored. "Comrades, we still have our strengths," Zhang told them all. "Of all the great powers of the world, only we have intercontinental missiles, and no one will dare strike us hard while we do." "Comrade, 2 days ago the Americans totally destroyed bridges so stout that one would have thought that only an angry deity could so much as scratch them. How secure can those missiles be when we face a foe with invisible aircraft and magical weapons?" Chan asked. "I think we may be approaching the time when Shen might wish to approach America and Russia to propose an end to hostilities," he concluded.
"You mean surrender?" Zhang asked angrily. "Never!"
It had already started, though the Politburo members didn't know it yet. All over China, but especially in Beijing, people owning computers had logged onto the Internet. This was especially true of young people, and university students most of all. The CIA feed, http://www.darkstarfeed.cia.gov/siberiabattle/realtime.ram, had attracted a global audience, catching even the international news organizations by surprise. CNN, Fox, and Europe's Sky News had immediately pirated it, and then called in their expert commentators to explain things to their viewers in the first continuous news coverage of an event since February of 1991. CIA had taken to pirating CNN in turn, and now available on the CIA website were live interviews from Chinese prisoners. They spoke freely, they were so shocked at their fates, stunned at how near they'd come to death, and so buoyantly elated at their equally amazing survival when so many of their colleagues had been less fortunate. That made for great verbosity, and it was also something that couldn't be faked. Any Chinese citizen could have spotted false propaganda, but equally, any could discern this sort of truth from what he saw and heard. The strange part was that Luo hadn't commented on the Internet phenomenon, thinking it irrelevant to the political facts of life in the PRC. But in that decision he'd made the greatest political misapprehension of his life. They met in college dorm rooms, first of all, amid clouds of cigarette smoke, chattering animatedly among themselves as students do, and like students everywhere they combined idealism with passion. That passion soon turned to resolve. By midnight they were meeting in larger groups. Some leaders emerged, and, being leaders, they felt the need to take their associates somewhere. When the crowds mingled outside, the individual leaders of smaller groups met and started talking, and super leaders emerged, rather like an instant military or political hierarchy, absorbing other groups into their own, until there were 6 principal leaders of a group of about 1,500 students. The larger group developed and then fed upon its own energy. Students everywhere are well supplied with piss and vinegar, and these Chinese students were no different. Some of the boys were there hoping to score with girls, another universal motivation for students. But the unifying factor here was rage at what had happened to their soldiers and their country, and even more rage at the lies that had gone out over state TV. Lies so clearly and utterly refuted by the reality they saw over the Internet, a source they'd learned to trust. There was only one place for them to go, Tiananmen Square, the square of heavenly peace, the psychological center of their country, and they were drawn there like iron filings to a magnet. The time of day worked for them. The police in Beijing, like police everywhere, worked 24-hour days divided into 3 unequal shifts, and the shift most lightly manned was that from 2300 to 0700. Most people were asleep then, and as a direct result, there was little crime to suppress,
and so this shift was the smallest in terms of manning, and also composed of those officers loved the least by their commanders, because no man in his right mind prefers the vampire life of wakefulness in darkness to that in the light of day. And so the few police on duty were those who had failed to distinguish themselves in their professional skills, or were disliked by their captains, and returned the compliment by not taking their duties with sufficient gravity. The appearance of the first students in the square was barely noted by the two policemen there. Their main duties involved directing traffic, and, or telling, frequently inebriated foreign tourists how to stumble back to their hotels. And the only danger they faced was usually that of being blinded by the flashes of foreign cameras held by oafishly pleasant but drunken guai. This new situation took them totally by surprise, and their first reaction was to do nothing but watch. The presence of so many young people in the square was unusual, but they weren't doing anything overtly unlawful at the moment, and so the police just looked on in a state of bemusement. They didn't even report what was going on because the watch captain was an ass who wouldn't have known what to do about it anyway.
"What if they strike at our nuclear arms?" Interior Minister Tong Jie asked.
"They already have," Zhang reminded them.
"They sank our missile submarine, you will recall. If they also strike at our land-based missiles, then it would mean they plan to attack us as a nation, not just our armed forces, for then they would have nothing to hold them back. It would be a grave and deliberate provocation, is that not so, Shen?"
The foreign minister nodded. "It would be an unfriendly act."
"How do we defend against it?" Tan Dashi asked.
"The missile field is located far from the borders. Each is in a heavily constructed concrete silo," Defense Minister Luo explained. "Moreover, we have recently fortified them further with steel armor to deflect bombs that might fall on them. The best way to add to their defense would be to deploy surface-to-air missiles."
"And if the Americans use their stealthy bombers, then what?" Tan asked.
"The defense against that is passive. The steel hats we put on the silos. We have troops there, security personnel of 2nd Artillery Command. But they are there only for site security against intruders on the ground. If such an attack should be made, we should launch them. The principle is to use them or lose them. An attack against our strategic weapons would have to be a precursor to an attack against our nationhood. That is our one trump card," Luo explained. "The one thing that even the Americans truly fear."
"Well, it should be," Zhang Hansan agreed.
"That is how we tell the Americans where they must stop and what they must do. In fact, it might now be a good time to tell the Americans that we have those missiles, and the willingness to use them if they press us too hard."
"Threaten the Americans with nuclear arms?" Fang asked. "Is that wise? They know of our weapons, surely. An overt threat against a powerful nation is most unwise."
"They must know that there are lines they may not cross," Zhang insisted. "They can hurt us, yes, but we can hurt them. And this is one weapon against which they have no defense. And their sentimentality for their people works for us, not them. It is time for America to regard us as an equal, not a minor country whose power they can blithely ignore."
"I repeat, comrade," Fang said, "that would be a most unwise act. When someone points a gun at your head, you do not try to frighten him."
"Fang, you have been my friend for many years, but in this you are wrong. It is we who hold that pistol now. The Americans only respect strength controlled by resolve. This will make them think. Luo, are the missiles ready for launch?" The defense minister shook his head.
"No, yesterday we did not agree to ready them. To do so takes about 2 hours, to load them with fuel. After that they can be kept in a ready condition for about 48 hours. Then you defuel them, service them. It takes about 4 hours to do that. And you can refuel them again. We could easily maintain half of them in a ready-launch condition indefinitely."
Comrades, I think it is in our interest to ready the missiles for flight.
No, Fung countered. That will be seen by the Americans as a dangerous provocation, and provoking them this way is madness.
And we should have Shen remind the Americans that we have such weapons, and they do not, Zhang went on.
That invites an attack on us, Fung nearly shouted. They do not have rockets, yes, but they have other ways of attacking us. And if we do that now, when a war is already underway, we guarantee a response.
I think not, Fung, Zhang replied.
They will not gamble millions of their citizens against all of ours. They have not the strength for such gambling.
Gambling, you say? Do we gamble with the life of our country?
Zhang, you are mad. This is lunacy, Fung insisted.
I do not have a vote at this table, Xian observed. But I have been a party member all of my adult life, and I have served the People's Republic well, I think. It is our job here to build a country, not destroy it.
What have we done here? We've turned China into a thief, a highway robber, and a failed highway robber at that.
Luo has said it. We have lost our play for riches, and now we must adjust to that. We can recover from the damage we have done to our country and its people. But recovery will require humility on our part, not blustering defiance. To threaten the Americans now is an act of weakness, not strength. It's the act of an impotent man trying to show off his gao. It will be seen by them as a foolish and reckless act.
If we are to survive as a nation, if we are to survive as the rulers of a powerful China, Zhang countered, we must let the Americans know that they cannot push us farther. Comrades, make no mistake. Our lives lie on this table.
And that focused the discussion.
I do not suggest that we launch a nuclear strike on America. I propose that we demonstrate to America our resolve, and if they press us too far, then we will punish them. And the Russians. Comrades, I propose that we fuel up our missiles, to place them in a ready posture, and then have Shen tell the Americans that there are limits beyond which we cannot be pushed without the gravest possible consequences.
No, Fung retorted.
That is tantamount to the threat of nuclear war. We must not do such a thing.
If we do not, then we are all doomed, said Tan Dexi of the Ministry of State Security.
I am sorry, Fung, but Zhang is correct here. Those are the only weapons with which we can hold the Americans back. They will be tempted to strike at them. And if they do, then we must use them, because if they take those weapons away from us, then they can strike us at will and destroy all we have built in 60 years, Zhang concluded.
I call a vote.
Suddenly and irrationally, Fung thought, the meeting had struck out on a path with no logic or direction, leading to disaster. But he was the only one who saw this, as for the first time in his life he took a stand against the others. The meeting finally broke up. The Politburo members drove directly home. None of them passed through Tiananmen Square on the way, and all of them fell rapidly asleep. There were 25 UH-60A Blackhawks and 15 Apaches on the ramp. Every one had stubby wings affixed to the fuselage. Those on the Blackhawks were occupied with fuel tanks. The Apaches had both fuel and rockets. The flight crews were grouped together, looking at maps. Clark took the lead. He was dressed in his black ninja gear, and a soldier directed him and Karelin. He was in the snowflake camouflage used by Russian airborne troops, to Colonel Boyle.
Howdy, Dick Boyle.
I'm John Clark, and this is Lieutenant General Yuri Karelin. I'm Rainbow, John explained. He's Spetsnaz.
Boyle saluted.
Well, I'm your driver, gentlemen. The objective is 716 miles away. We can just about make it with the fuel we're carrying, but we're going to have to tank up on the way back. We're doing that right here. He pointed to a spot on the navigation chart. Hilltop west of this little town named Chichang. We got lucky. Two C-130s are going to do bladder drops for us.
There will be a fighter escort for top cover, F-15s, plus some F-16s to go after any radars along the way. And when we get to about here, 8 F-117s are going to trash this fighter base at Anshan. That should take care of any Chinese fighter interference. Now, this missile base has an associated security force, supposed to be battalion strength, in barracks located here. This time it was a satellite photo. And 5 of my Apaches are going to take that place down with rockets. The others will be flying direct support. The only other question is, how close do you want us to put you on these missile silos? Land right on top of the bastards, Clark told him, looking over at Carillon. I agree. The closer the better. Boyle nodded. Fair enough. The helicopters all have numbers on them indicating the silo they're flying for. I'm flying lead, and I'm going right to this one here. That means I go with you, Clark told him. How many? 10 plus me. Okay, your chem gear's in the aircraft. Suit up and we go. Latrines that way, Boyle pointed. It would be better for every man to take a piss before the flight began. 15 minutes. Clark went that way, and so did Carillon. Both old soldiers knew what they needed to do in most respects, and this one was as vital as loading a weapon. Have you been to China before, John? Nope. Taiwan once, long ago, to get screwed, blued, and tattooed. No chance for that on this trip. We are both too old for this, you know. I know, Clark said, zipping himself up. But you're not going to sit back here, are you? Our leader must be with his men, Ivan Timofeyevich. That is true, Yuri. Good luck. They will not launch a nuclear attack on my country, or on yours, Carillon promised. Not while I live. You know, Yuri, you might have been a good guy to have in Third SOG. And what is that, John? When we get back and have a few drinks, I will tell you. The troops suited up outside their designated helicopters. The U.S. Army chemical gear was bulky, but not grossly so. Like many American issue items, it was an evolutionary development of a British idea, with charcoal inside the lining to absorb and neutralize toxic gas, and a hood that... We can't use our radios with this, Mike Pierce noted. Screws up the antenna. Try this, Homer Johnston suggested, disconnecting the antenna and tucking it into the helmet cover. Good one, Homer, Eddie Price said, watching what he did and trying it himself. The American pattern Kevlar helmet fit nicely into the hoods, which they left off in any case as too uncomfortable until they really needed it. That done, they loaded into their helicopters, and the flight crews spooled up the General Electric turboshaft engines. The Blackhawks lifted off. The special operations troops were set in what were, for military aircraft, comfortable seats, held in place with 4-point safety belts. Clark took the jump seat, aft and between the two pilots, and tied into the intercom. "Who exactly are you?" Boyle asked. "Well, I have to kill you after I tell you, but I'm CIA. Before that, Navy." "Seal?" Boyle asked. "Budweiser badge and all. Couple years ago, we set up this group called Rainbow, Special Operations, Counter-Terror, that sort of thing." "The amusement park job?" "That's us." "You had a 60 supporting you for that. Who's the driver?" "Dan Malloy. Goes by Bear when he's driving. Know him?" "Marine, right?" "Yep." Clark nodded. "Never met him. Heard about him a little. I think he's in D.C. now." "Yeah, when he left us, he took over VMH-1. "Flies the president?" "Correct." "Bummer," Boyle observed. "How long you been doing this?" "Flying choppers? Oh, 18 years. 4,000 hours. I was born in the Huey and grew up into these. Qualified in the Apache, too." "What do you think of the mission?" John asked. "Long," was the reply. And Clark hoped that was the only cause for concern. A sore ass you could recover from quickly enough. "I wish there was another way to do this one, Robbie,"
Ryan said over lunch. It seemed utterly horrid to be sitting here in the White House mess, eating a cheeseburger with his best friend, while others, including two people he knew well, Jack had learned, were heading into harm's way. It was enough to kill his appetite, as dead as the low-cholesterol beef in the bun. He set it down and sipped at his Coke.
Well, there is. If you want to wait the 2 days it's going to take Lockheed Martin to assemble the bombs, then a day to fly them to Siberia, and another 12 hours to fly the mission. Maybe longer.
The Black Jet only flies at night, remember, the Vice President pointed out.
You're handling it better than I am.
Jack, I don't like it any more than you do, okay? But after 20 years of flying off carriers, you learn to handle the stress of having friends in tight corners. If you don't, might as well turn in your wings. Eat, man. You need your strength. How's Andrea doing?
That generated an ironic smile.
Puked her guts out this morning. Had her use my own crapper. It's killing her. She was embarrassed as a guy caught naked in Times Square.
Well, she's in a man's job, and she doesn't want to be seen as a wimp, Robbie explained. Hard to be one of the boys when you don't have a dick, but she tries real hard. I'll give her that.
Kathy says it passes, but it isn't passing fast enough for her.
He looked over to see Andrea standing in the doorway, always the watchful protector of her president.
She's a good troop, Jackson agreed.
How's your dad doing?
Not too bad. Some TV ministry agency wants him and Jerry Patterson to do some more salt and pepper shows on Sunday mornings. He's thinking about it. The money could dress up the church some.
They were impressive together.
Yeah, Jerry didn't do bad for a white boy. And he's actually a pretty good guy, Pap says. I'm not sure of this TV ministry stuff, though. Too easy to go Hollywood and start playing to the audience instead of being a shepherd to your flock.
Your father's a pretty impressive gent, Robbie.
Jackson looked up.
I'm glad you think so. He raised us pretty good, and it was pretty tough on him after Mom died. But he can be a real sundowner. Gets all pissy when he sees me drink a beer. But what the hell, it's his job to yell at people, I suppose.
Tell him that Jesus played bartender once. It was his first public miracle.
I've pointed that out, and then he says, if Jesus wants to do it, that's okay for Jesus, boy, but you ain't Jesus.
The Vice President had a good chuckle.
Eat, Jack.
Yes, Mom.
This food isn't half bad, Al Gregory said, 2 miles away in the wardroom of USS Gettysburg.
Well, no women and no booze on a ship of war, Captain Blandy pointed out. Not this one yet, anyway. You have to have some diversion. So, how are the missiles?
The software is fully loaded, and I emailed the upgrade, like you said. So all the other Aegis ships ought to have it.
Just heard this morning that the Aegis office in the Pentagon is having a bit of a conniption fit over this. They didn't approve the software.
Tell him to take it up with Tony Britano, Gregory suggested.
Explain to me again, what exactly did you upgrade?
The Seeker software on the missile warhead. I cut down the lines of code so it can recycle more quickly. And I reprogrammed the nutation rate on the laser on the fusing system so that I can handle a higher rate of closure. It should obviate the problem the Patriots had with the Scuds back in 91. I helped with that software fix, too, back then, but this one's about half an order of magnitude faster.
Without a hardware fix? The skipper asked.
It would be better to increase the range of the laser, yes, but you can get away without it. At least it worked okay on the computer simulations.
Hope to hell we don't need to prove it.
Oh, yeah, Captain. A nuke headed for a city is a bad thing.
Amen.
There were 5,000 of them now, with more coming, summoned by the cell phones that they all seemed to have. Some even had portable computers tied into cellular phones so that they could tap into the internet site out here in the open. It was a clear night, with no rain to wreck a computer. The leaders of the crowd, they now thought of it as a demonstration, huddled around them to see more, and then relayed it to their friends.
The first big student uprising in Tiananmen Square had been fueled by faxes. This one had taken a leap forward in technology. Mainly, they milled around, talking excitedly with one another and summoning more help. The first such demonstration had failed. But they'd all been toddlers then, and their memory of it was sketchy at best. They were all old and educated enough to know what needed changing, but not yet old and experienced enough to know that change in their society was impossible. And they didn't know what a dangerous combination that could be. The ground below was dark and unlit. Even their night vision goggles didn't help much, showing only rough terrain features, mainly the tops of hills and ridges. There were few lights below. There were some houses and other buildings, but at this time of night few people were awake, and all of the lights were turned off. The only moving light sources they could see were the rotor tips of the helicopters, heated by air friction to the point that they would be painful to touch, and hot enough to glow in the infrared spectrum that the night goggles could detect. Mainly the troops were lulled into stuporous lassitude by the unchanging vibration of the aircraft, and the semi-dreaming state that came with it helped to pass the time. That was not true of Clark, who sat in the jump seat, looking down at the satellite photos of the missile base at Xuan Hua, studying by the illumination of the IR light on his goggles, looking for information he might have missed on first and 21st inspection. He was confident in his men. Chavez had turned into a fine tactical leader, and the troops, experienced sergeants all, would do what they were told to the extent of their considerable abilities. The Russians in the other helicopters would do okay too, he thought. Younger, by 8 years on average, than the Rainbow Troopers, they were all commissioned officers, mainly lieutenants and captains with a leavening of a few majors, and all were university graduates, well-educated, and that was almost as good as 5 years in uniform. Better yet, they were well-motivated young professional soldiers, smart enough to think on their feet, and proficient in their weapons. The mission should work, John thought. He leaned to check the clock on the helicopter's instrument panel. 40 minutes, and they'd find out. Turning around, he noticed the eastern sky was lightening, according to his goggles. They'd hit the missile field just before dawn. It was a stupidly easy mission for the black jets, arriving overhead singly, about 30 seconds apart. Each opened its bomb bay doors and dropped two weapons, 10 seconds apart. Each pilot, his plane controlled by its automatic cruising system, put his laser dot on a pre-planned section of the runway. The bombs were the earliest Paveway 2 guidance packages bolted to Mark 84 2,000-pound bombs with cheap, $7.95 each, in fact, M905 fuses set to go off a hundredth of a second after impact, so as to make a hole in the concrete about 20 feet across by 9 feet deep. And this all 16 of them did, to the shocked surprise of the sleepy tower crew, and with enough noise to wake up every person within a 5-mile radius. And just that fast, Anshan Fighter Base was closed, and would remain so for at least a week. The 8 F-117s turned singly and made their way back to their base at Zhigansk. Flying the black jet wasn't supposed to be any more exciting than driving a 737 for Southwest Airlines. And, for the most part, it wasn't. "Why the hell didn't they send one of those dark stars down to cover the mission?" Jack asked. "I suppose it never occurred to anybody," Jackson said. They were back in the Situation Room. "What about satellite overheads?" "Not this time," Ed Foley advised. "Next Passover is in about 4 hours. Clark has a satellite phone. He'll clue us in." "Great." Ryan leaned back in a chair that suddenly wasn't terribly comfortable. "Objective in sight," Boyle said over the intercom. Then the radio. "Bandit 6 to Chicks. Objective in sight. Check in, over." 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Cochise, check in.
This is Cochise leader with 5. We have the objective.
Crook with 5, objective in sight, the second attack helicopter team reported.
Okay, move in as briefed. Execute, execute, execute.
Clark was perked up now, as were the troops in the back. Sleep was shaken off, and adrenaline flooded into their bloodstreams. He saw them shake their heads and flex their jaws. Weapons were tucked in tight, and every man moved his left hand to the twist dial release fitting on the belt buckle. Cochise's flight went in first, heading for the barracks of the security battalion tasked to guard the missile base. The building could have been transported bodily from any World War II American Army base, a 2-story wood frame construction with a pitched roof and painted white. There was a guard shack outside, also painted white, and it glowed in the thermal sights of the Apache gunners. They could even see the 2 soldiers there, doubtless approaching the end of their duty tour, standing slackly, their weapons slung over their shoulders, because nobody ever came out here, rarely enough during the day, and never in living memory at night. Unless you counted the battalion commander coming back drunk from a command staff meeting. Their heads twisted slightly when they thought they heard something strange. But the 4-bladed rotor on the Apache was also designed for sound suppression. And so they were still looking when they saw the first flash. The weapons selected were the 2.75-inch diameter free-flight rockets, carried in pods on the Apache's stub wings. 3 of the section of 5 handled the initial firing run, with 2 in reserve should the unexpected develop. They burned in low so as to conceal their silhouettes in the hills behind them, and opened up at 200 meters. The first salvo of 4 blew up the guard shack and its 2 sleepy guards. The noise would have been enough to awaken those in the barracks building, but the second salvo of rockets, this time 15 of them, got there before anyone inside could do more than blink his eyes open. Both floors of the 2-story structure were hit, and most of those inside died without waking, caught in the middle of dreams. The Apaches hesitated then, still having weapons to fire. There was a subsidiary guard post on the other side of the building. Cochise lead looped around the barracks and spotted it. The 2 soldiers there had their rifles up and fired blindly into the air. But his gunner selected his 20-millimeter cannon and swept them aside as though with a broom. Then the Apache pivoted in the air, and he salvoed his remaining rockets into the barracks. And it was immediately apparent that if anyone was alive in there, it was by the grace of God himself, and whoever it was would not be a danger to the mission.
Cochise 4 and 5, lead. Go back up Crook. We don't need you here.
Roger, lead, they both replied. The 2 attack helicopters moved off, leaving the first 3 to look for and erase any signs of life. Crook flight, also of 5 Apaches, smoked in just ahead of the Blackhawks. It turned out that each silo had a small guard post, each for 2 men, and those were disposed of in a matter of seconds with cannon fire. Then the Apaches climbed to higher altitude and circled slowly, each over a pair of missile silos, looking for anything moving but seeing nothing. Bandit 6, Colonel Dick Boyle, flared his Blackhawk 3 feet over silo number 1, as it was marked on his satellite photo.
Go! The co-pilot shouted over the intercom.
The Rainbow Troopers jumped down just to the east of the actual hole itself. The Chinese hat steel structure, which looked like an inverted blunt ice cream cone, prohibited dropping right down on the door itself. The base command post was the best protected structure on the entire post. It was buried 10 meters underground, and the 10 meters was solid reinforced concrete, so as to survive a nuclear bomb's exploding within 100 meters, or so the design supposedly promised. Inside was a staff of 10. Commanded by Major General Shun Qingyan. He'd been a 2nd Artillery, the Chinese name for their strategic missile troops, officer, since graduating from university with an engineering degree. Only 3 hours before, he'd supervised the fueling of all 12 of his CSS-4 intercontinental ballistic missiles, which had never happened before in his memory. No explanation had come with that order, though it didn't take a rocket scientist, which he was by profession,
to connect it with the war underway against Russia. Like all members of the People's Liberation Army, he was a highly disciplined man, and always mindful of the fact that he had his country's most valuable military assets under his personal control. The alarm had been raised by one of the silo guard posts, and his staff switched on the television cameras used for site inspection and surveillance. They were old cameras and needed lights, which were switched on as well.
"What the fuck?" Chavez shouted. "Turn the lights off!" he ordered over his radio.
It wasn't demanding. The light standards weren't very tall, nor were they very far away. Chavez hosed one with his MP10, and the lights went out, thank you. No other lasted for more than 5 seconds at any of the silos.
"We are under attack," General Shun said in a quiet and disbelieving voice. "We are under attack," he repeated.
But he had a drill for this.
"Alert the guard force," he told one NCO. "Get me Beijing," he ordered another.
At silo number one, Paddy Connolly ran to the pipes that led to the top of the concrete box that marked the top of the silo. To each, he stuck a block of Composition B, his explosive of choice. Into each block, he inserted a blasting cap. Two men, Eddie Price and Hank Patterson, knelt close by with their weapons ready for a response force that was nowhere to be seen.
"Fire in the hole!"
Patterson shouted, running back to the other two. There he skidded down to the ground, sheltered behind the concrete, and twisted the handle on his detonator. The two pipes were blown apart a millisecond later.
"Masks!"
he told everyone on the radio. But there was no vapor coming off the fueling pipes. That was good news, wasn't it?
"Come on!"
Eddie Price yelled at him. The three men, guarded now by two others, looked for the metal door into the maintenance entrance for the silo.
"Ed, we're on the ground. We're on the ground," Clark was saying into his satellite phone 50 yards away.
"The barracks are gone, and there's no opposition on the ground here. Doing our blasting now. Back to you soon. Out."
"Well, shit," Ed Foley said in his office. But the line was now dead.
What? It was an hour later in Beijing, and the sun was up. Marshal Luo, having just woken up after not enough sleep following the worst day he'd known since the Cultural Revolution, had a telephone thrust into his hands.
"What is this?" he demanded of the phone. "This is Major General Shun Qingyan at Chuanhuan Missile Base. We are under attack here. There is a force of men on the ground over our heads trying to destroy our missiles. I require instructions."
"Fight them off," was the first idea Luo had.
"The defense battalion is dead. They do not respond. Comrade Minister, what do I do?"
"Are your missiles fueled and ready for launch?"
"Yes."
Luo looked around his bedroom, but there was no one to advise him. His country's most priceless assets were now about to be ripped from his control. His command wasn't automatic. He actually thought first, but in the end it wouldn't matter how considered his decision was.
"Launch your missiles," he told the distant general officer.
"Repeat your command," Luo heard.
"Launch your missiles," his voice boomed. "Launch your missiles now!"
"By your command," the voice replied.
"Fuck," Sergeant Connolly said. "This is some bloody door."
The first explosive block had done nothing more than scorch the paint. This time he attached a hollow charge to the upper and lower hinges and backed off again.
"This one will do it," he promised as he trailed the wires back.
The crash that followed gave proof to his words. When next they looked in, the door was gone. It had been hurled inward. Must have flown into the silo like a bat out of...
"Bloody hell!"
Connolly turned.
"Run! Run!"
Price and Patterson needed no encouragement. They ran for their lives. Connolly caught them reaching for his protective hood as he did so, not stopping until he was over 100 yards away.
"The bloody missile's fueled. The door ruptured the upper tank. It's going to blow." "Shit."
"Team, this is Price. The missiles are fueled. I repeat, the missiles are fueled. Get the fucking hell away from the silo." The proof of that came from silo number 8, off to Price's south. The concrete structure that sat atop it surged into the air, and under it was a volcanic blast of fire and smoke.
Silo number one, theirs, did the same, a gout of flame going sideways out of the open service door. The infrared signature was impossible to miss. Over the equator, a DSP satellite focused in on the thermal bloom and cross-loaded the signal to Sunnyvale, California. From there it went to NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, dug into the sub-basement level of Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado.
Launch! Possible launch at Chuanhua!
What's that? Asked Sync NORAD.
We got a bloom, a huge... Two huge ones at Chuanhua, the female captain announced. Fuck, there's another one!
Okay, Captain, settle down, the four-star told her. There's a special op taking that base down right now. Settle down, girl. In the control bunker, men were turning keys. The general in command had never really expected to do this. Sure, it was a possibility, the thing he'd trained his entire career for, but no, not this. No, not a chance. But someone was trying to destroy his command. And he did have his orders, and like the automaton he'd been trained to be, he gave the orders and turned his command key. The Spetsnaz people were doing well. Four silos were now disabled. One of the Russian teams managed to crack the maintenance door on their first try. This team, General Kirillin's own, sent its technical genius inside, and he found the missile's guidance module and blew it apart with gunfire. It would take a week at least to fix this missile, and just to make sure that didn't happen, he affixed an explosive charge to the stainless steel body and set the timer for 15 minutes.
Done, he called.
Out, Kirillin ordered. The lieutenant general, now feeling like a new cadet in parachute school, gathered his team and ran to the pickup point. As guilty as any man would be of mission focus, he looked around, surprised by the fire and flame to his north. But more surprised to see three silo covers moving. The nearest was only 300 meters away, and there he saw one of his Spetsnaz troopers walk right to the suddenly open silo and toss something in. Then he ran like a rabbit, because 3 seconds later, the hand grenade he'd tossed in exploded, and took the entire missile up with it. The Spetsnaz soldier disappeared in the fireball he'd caused, and would not be seen again. But then something worse happened. From exhaust vents set left and right of silos number 5 and number 7 came two vertical fountains of solid white-yellow flame, and less than 2 seconds later appeared the blunt, black shape of a missile's nose cone.
Fuck! Breathed the Apache pilot, coded Crook 2.
He was circling a kilometer away, and without any conscious thought at all, lowered his nose, twisted throttle, and pulled collective to jerk his attack helicopter at the rising missile.
Got it, the gunner called.
He selected his 20-millimeter cannon and held down the trigger. The tracers blazed out like laser beams. The first set missed, but the gunner adjusted his lead and walked them into the missile's upper half. The resulting explosion threw Crook 2 out of control, rolling it over on its back. The pilot threw his cyclic to the left, continuing the roll before he stopped it, barely, a quarter of the way through the second one, and then he saw the fireball rising, and the burning missile fuel falling back to the ground, atop silo number 9, and on all the men there who'd disabled that bird. The last missile cleared its silo before the soldiers there could do much about it. Two tried to shoot at it with their personal weapons, but the flaming exhaust incinerated them in less time than it takes to pull a trigger. Another Apache swept in, having seen what Crook 2 had accomplished, but its rounds fell short. So rapidly the CSS-4 climbed into the air.
"Oh, fuck!"
Clark heard in his radio earpiece. It was Ding's voice.
"Oh, fuck!"
John got back on his satellite phone.
"Yeah, how's it going?" Ed Foley asked.
"One got off. One got away, man."
"What?"
"You heard me. We killed all but one, but that one got off. Going north, but leaning east some."
"Sorry, Ed. We tried."
It took Foley a few seconds to gather his thought and reply.
"Thanks, John. I guess I have some things to do here."
"There's another one," the captain said. Sync NORAD was trying to play this